I'm getting outside of the world tonight. I'm feeling so spent.
Welcome, ladies, gentlemen, fellow slaves of the global plantation. The Vinnie Eastwood Show is bad news. It's like the news, but worse. So much worse. It's the lighter side of genocide. Just because we're being exterminated doesn't mean we can't enjoy it. Otherwise, what's the point of being killed? The Vinnie Eastwood Show, where the only thing worse than living in a high-tech global police state run by child trafficking Satanists is Vinnie's jokes. Seriously, one of these days he's going to get the bash. And my very special guest that I'm joined by today is Abe Gray of the New Zealand Cannabis Museum. So hello, Abe.
Hey, thanks for having me, Vinnie. And I can confirm your jokes are much worse than any torture I've been subjected to under prohibition.
Yes, indeed. Because unlike arrest and detainment, you can't escape from Vinnie's jokes. Now, the thing that we're talking about here today on republicbroadcasting.org, thank you very much for watching, everybody. And also, those of you who are watching, you often get these YouTube notifications, and then when you go to the YouTube notifications, you notice the video's not there, and that's because often we say things on the air that we're not allowed to say on YouTube, so we upload them instead to BitChute, Rumble, and Odyssey. So just search Vinnie Eastwood on those, and the best nexus point is to go to the vinnieeastwoodshow.com and click on latest, and you have all the shows archived there and links to the subsequent platforms that you can watch the censored broadcasts on. This is probably not going to be one of those episodes, though. Well, one can only hope.
I was going to say, Vinnie, like, I've known you for 20 years, and in that time, this topic that we're going to discuss today has fallen down the global rankings of controversy.
Yeah, I mean, maybe it's because people are just too blazed to give a flying if, you know, it's, I mean, I'm just making this up as I go along. But anyway, Abe, thank you very much for joining us, and would you please let us know, I haven't actually set up the stream properly to have your name and everything there, so while you're explaining who you are and what it is you do, I'm going to correct all the stream stuff up back here.
Sure. So my name is Abe Gray. I am a cannabis activist for the last, 24 years now. And in New Zealand for the past 20. And I guess I'm also the curator of the Whakamana Cannabis Museum, New Zealand's first and only cannabis museum. And I think the fourth cannabis museum ever in the world. Now there's about 15 or 20 of them. So we've been around as a museum for about 10 years, although we have been in storage for the last couple of years due to what we could euphemistically call the downturn in tourism and hospitality. But that's all over now. And in New Zealand, just coincidentally at the same time that sort of commerce is coming back, we've had the introduction of medical marijuana legislation for the first time in New Zealand history. And it's been on the books for about 5 years, but it's only just in the past 12 months that we've had approved prescription products for THC dry flower. And so that's really changed the equation in terms of cannabis culture in New Zealand, because THC flower is now open carry. So cannabis has been legalized in New Zealand if you have a prescription, despite the fact that we had an adult use referendum that narrowly failed. And everybody thinks that, you know, we lost on cannabis and nothing's going to happen for a long time in this country. Well, for those policy nerds like us, Vinnie, who have been watching the space, we're actually in a really good place right now. And I'm excited to leverage that in the public conversation and let people realize that adult cannabis use has a therapeutic dimension. It's now sanctioned under the medicinal cannabis legislation that we have. And that means those of us who are responsible, non-problematic adult cannabis users, we can celebrate our culture like they do in mature markets in North America.
It should be noted that when police are looking for cannabis users, and I know this firsthand, when I asked an officer what he looks for, he says groups of males under the age of 25. Right? And to my knowledge, that's not the majority of cannabis users. And therefore, basically, it's kind of like, who do you go after that probably doesn't have a lawyer, probably doesn't know to keep their mouth shut, probably doesn't know X, Y, Z, and stuff like that. It's predatory in nature. You know, I'm sorry to say this, but that's basically how the cannabis laws have been enforced in this country for a significant period of time in a very predatory manner. I recall, what was her name, the Green Fairy who came out publicly giving Jacinda Ardern support in the 2017 election, and she was giving people medicinal cannabis for free in some cases just to help with their pain. And after that election, what was promised was that cannabis would be legalized, but what actually happened was the police turned up to this Green Fairy's property and took all her plants and charged her.
Yeah, well, cannabis prohibition has always been a racist propaganda tool ever since its inception 100 years ago. You know, it was a public health panic created by powerful corporations demonizing Mexicans and black jazz musicians as a way to sort of drive a wedge through the social fabric of the United States at that time. And that tool of control of an arbitrary substance that, you know, quite a few people will have, but then you as a law enforcer have the discretion to choose whether or not to sort of prosecute them over it. So yes, as you say, lots of people in New Zealand use cannabis, but the police only seem to go after those under 25 and particularly those with brown skin. And that was the case, you know, in ever since the inception of prohibition. It's been a sort of an adjunct to policing, an arbitrary tool that can be used to sort of persecute anyone at will because it's such a common behavior.
The term at will, right? Political will. Let's say you needed political will to go after the cannabis prohibition and stop it from happening. How can you generate that if the only people who are really affected by it and hurt by it are in their mid-20s with the least amount of power, the least amount of resources, and the least amount of influence in terms of the social demographics, right?
Yeah. Well, that's what we mean. I mean, we had 100 years of inertia, and the 20 years that I lived in New Zealand, I mean, when I immigrated here in 2002, I thought that the argument had been won and legalization was in the pipeline. And then it was just, you know, the results of a certain election propelling Peter Dunn into a position of influence that kind of undid all that work. So it wasn't based on like fact and logic. It was political maneuvering, right? And so, yeah, as you say, when the pathologized conception of cannabis in the public mind is only people in jail, only people going to hospital, you know, young brown people being arrested, that's the tip of the iceberg. We're not seeing the normal, non-problematic, ubiquitous adult use that's in our society because that taboo and the legal risk has sort of incentivized all the other users to keep quiet and be afraid. And, you know, that making an example of those young brown people served to sufficiently scare a lot of people for a long time. Now, you know, people like you and me, we've been activists standing up for what we think is right, but that didn't necessarily get a lot of traction. But piece by piece.
Oh, we seem to have lost Abe there. Hopefully he'll pick up the call again. Sorry, Abe, we had just a dropout there. Sorry, go right ahead.
Oh, what I was going to say is, yeah, so that taboo and that inertia has been in place for 100 years. But if you bang your head against a brick wall long enough, cracks do start to appear. And I think that's what we've seen. And I guess when I started out, it was all about civil disobedience. You know, we used to hotbox the police station and political conventions and stuff. But the rhetoric has moved on. And what we realized is, like, we started by hotboxing the police station. And then we started, like, a club. We had a club on campus, and we started gathering every week, meeting up for the 420 protests. I know you know very well. You were there. That's what evolved into the museum. And so we were always trying to make a place for unashamed consumption, right? Because we thought that the premier act of civil disobedience was to actually consume it, because that was the taboo, right? We could talk about cannabis legalization, we could debate about it, but God forbid someone actually, like, lit up a joint. That was, like, the cardinal sin. And that's what drove us. That's why we did it. It's like, what good is discussing cannabis use or, you know, reforming cannabis laws if we're not actually allowed to use it? That's the point, right? So we started, like, you know, it was organic the way the 420s began. It was like a gathering of people with that safety in numbers under the guise of civil disobedience that, well, until recently had a sacred place in New Zealand. The police used to be a bit more reluctant to bash up protesters back in the day, especially for cannabis. And so we kind of exploited that loophole and managed to grow a cannabis cultural festival, you know, a community, if you will. And so what we saw in that time was that the non-problematic adult use is what's defensible. You know, like teenagers playing video games or, you know, doing vandalism, the kind of pathologized stereotype of cannabis use, that's not the majority. And that's not what we should be trying to defend. What we should be pointing out is the majority of users are actually normal, professional, productive citizens, engaged citizens, and that's what we should be trying to defend. So we need to come away from this pathologized lens of cannabis and start speaking about the positive things, you know, that come from cannabis. And as we developed that rhetoric about non-problematic adult use and, you know, engaged citizens, that example of a positive example of a cannabis user is very similar to the criteria that a doctor now uses to assess a patient if they should be prescribed. Essentially, you know, you have to be getting a benefit out of it. You have to be not sort of any harms that you might be experiencing have to be outweighed by those benefits. And, you know, you have to make sure you're not exposing yourself to risk factors like mixing medications or substances. So what a GP now, the way they assess a cannabis user to see if they should be prescribed is almost exactly the same as the systems that we developed over a decade to assess, is this person a defensible cannabis user? Should we allow them into our club? Because if the media sees us all using and, you know, looks at our backgrounds and digs through the skeletons in our closet, are we going to be able, with a straight face, to look them in the eye and defend our use and say we're not ashamed? And so that's really dovetailed the idea of the adult cannabis use that we were trying to defend just on the principles of human rights and decency, and the recognition of non-problematic adult cannabis use with a therapeutic dimension as legitimate medical.
Well, the old saying is that all cannabis use is medical use. And I believe an article came out of the Guardian a number of years ago saying they conducted a survey of what you'd call recreational cannabis users And it turned out that the reason why they were using it is because they had some kind of undiagnosed health condition that the cannabis was helping.
Well, that's right. And so, and that's what we need to understand. Like, the majority of cannabis users, I mean, you and I are both cannabis users. Sorry to give away any confidential information there, but it's, we're not dissociative. It's not like ketamine or meth, you know, it's like, it's enhancing our experience, right? We're not like out of it, like, you know, yeah, it's not a dissociative drug. It's not like alcohol. It's something that, you know, enhances our daily experience. And so if we can communicate that, then that's legitimate. And, you know, like people talk about recreational use, right? Like that's somehow not defensible because it's just hedonistic. And, you know, we want to change the rhetoric to adult use because just to come away from that hedonistic idea, you know, there's lots of reasons that adults use cannabis. And it's not just pure hedonism. But even if you examine the idea of recreation, like what is recreation? It's like, it's something that brings you sort of positive feelings. It's like an activity that, you know, relieves stress and brings you joy. Those are therapeutic benefits. Recreation is a therapeutic activity. So recreational cannabis use, you know, even if you think of it in that lens, still has a, you know, a defensible therapeutic dimension to it. And let's not forget mindfulness, relaxation. Those are like the hottest things in wellness right now. That's what I get when I smoke cannabis. I mean, I don't know about you, Vinny, but when I have a toke and I have that introspective journey and overthink things and think about things from other people's perspectives and, you know, increase my empathy, that's actually like mindfulness. That's what people, you know, have other ways of doing meditation, you know, all sorts of ceremonies to induce those reflective states. And that's healthy. That's therapeutic. That's good. A good GP will recognize that as a legitimate therapeutic benefit that deserves a prescription for cannabis.
Well, yeah, and there's those people who say that they don't need cannabis and they do their hours of meditation a day or they pray to God or something like that, whereas I think just by using cannabis, you're just cutting out the middleman and going straight to source.
I don't have the time to sit there for a couple of hours. A toke is sort of instantaneous. That's how I get my mindfulness.
Yeah, takes about 30 seconds, you know, so in a busy society with drive-through and cell phones, cannabis is basically finding itself a niche.
Yeah, and I mean, I don't, you know, we don't want to necessarily see the Walmartization of cannabis like they have in America. There's, you know, there's a happy medium for, you know, local decentralized solutions, but I guess that's kind of a different topic.
Yeah. So the Cannabis Museum itself, because cannabis has such a long history, I think basically as far as human recorded history is concerned, cannabis and human recorded history go hand in hand because it's our first crop 10,000 years ago and that's what started civilization, right?
Yes.
So basically, if you look at it inherently, cannabis being illegal or being seen in any way by anybody as a bad thing in its entirety is basically saying that history doesn't matter, humans don't matter, and truth doesn't matter, right? That's basically what I see and hear when these people are rubbishing it.
Yeah, well, look at it this way. As you said correctly, cannabis was the very first crop cultivated for agriculture. And look, it's not, you know, carbon dating isn't precise enough to definitively say that it was the very first and agriculture developed in multiple regions independently. But if you look at those early crops, which we can all agree on, you know, wheat, maize, rice, sorghum, those type of things, cannabis as well, they're all foods. All they basically provide is food. Cannabis also provides fiber, you know, net, ropes, sailing, fishing nets, clothing, all of that technology that we associate with civilization. It wasn't coming from wheat and rice and sorghum, I'll tell you that. So, You know, even if you think all these crops were sort of equal, you know, like came about at the same time, cannabis was clearly economically much more valuable as a commodity to early humans.
Are you one of the millions of people who feel like there is a dark cloud hanging?
Welcome back. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to another exciting episode of the Vinnie Eastwood Show, available at thevinnieeastwoodshow.com. That's Vinnie with a Y, because it's the most important question in Eastwood. Like, go ahead, make my news. And over there you can, if I can bring the thing up for people to see. No, that's the wrong one. Never mind. Sorry, guys. Had a heck of a day yesterday, so I'm still trying to catch up and wake up, as it were. So the show has been going for since about 2008, I think, and officially became a radio broadcast in 2010. So if you go onto the archives and things of that nature on the Vinnie Eastwood Show, you'll literally find thousands upon thousands of interviews with people from all over the world across subject matters. So I would like to encourage people to go and do that and go look through the backlog, because after the deplatforming sensations, as many people who've been broadcasting the truth have discovered of late and of recent, all my work is basically gone from the platforms where you would be able to search them or when you would look at them. And so on the little platforms like Odyssey, BitChute, Rumble, things of that nature, most people aren't on those platforms and they ain't looking for the things. So the majority of the backlog on those things has like zero views. So it's a whole bunch of knowledge that has basically been lost to the human race because of the deplatforming efforts of those who wish to destroy everything that matters to it. So yeah, I would like some help, ladies and gentlemen. Please go to the vinnieeastwoodshow.com and donate today. Some gifts and weekly, monthly automatic payments, and the Kiwi Bank and Patreon as well, where you can support me through my band Vinnie and the Vendettas, who provide all the music for the show today. My very special guest is Abe Gray from the New Zealand Cannabis Museum, who actually sold me weed once when I was a student in Dunedin. Thank you very much for that, by the way, Abe. It was fantastic.
Well, I thought it was you that sold me weed, so I remember that. But it probably happened in both directions, to be honest, back then.
Yeah.
What I was saying before that very, very topical commercial break, cannabis, you know, as far as ancient crops go, even if you don't believe that it was the first, which doesn't really matter, it was the most valuable because it wasn't just a food. It was also an industrial feedstock. And it was really the only industrial feedstock of all of that sort of early fiber technology, sailing, fishing, clothing. But that's not even including the spiritual dimension of it, the drug value, like, as a powerful therapeutic agent. And also something that stimulates that mindfulness that we were just discussing. It was the penultimate plant of human civilization. It catalyzed human civilization, and it was the most valuable economic commodity. So if you think of, I'm a botanist by trade, and in botany, there's a field of economic botany, which kind of values the global market cap of, say, individual plants. And if we look at the global commodity value of, you know, those industrial feedstocks for humanity, which mostly all, you know, besides oil and petrochemicals, all come from plants. And so you can value them, you know, in the billions of dollars, the total market for, say, wheat globally or corn globally. Now, if you go all the way back 10,000 years in human history, you can rank all of those commodity species in terms of their market value. And cannabis was number one. And all the way through 10,000 years of human history, cannabis was always the most valuable, the most important. The naval armadas of the 15 to 1700s would not have existed without the fiber for re-rigging and re-sailing those ships. Like, what we think of as the feedstock for the war machine today in the form of oil, the medieval war machines of those ancient empires was hemp. And so, like, the way that empires fight to control the means of production for oil geographically, that used to be fought over the lands that could be used to produce hemp, because the size of your naval armada was directly correlated to the amount of agricultural land that you had within your empire to produce hemp to keep fueling that war machine. So all the way through to the 1800s, cannabis was the number one global most valuable commodity in human civilization this whole time. And it was only when petrochemicals came on the scene to sort of replace some of those feedstocks, you know, with lubricants, with fuel, with synthetic fibers. Basically, those elements couldn't compete with hemp. They were expensive to produce. You had to, you know, mine them, refine them, all of this crap. And prohibition can be directly, you know, a straight line can be drawn between those industries, among others, wood, paper, pulp, pharmaceutical drugs, sort of colluding to create a scare story about cannabis and, you know, associate it with racist tropes of the time and gin up like a mass panic, sort of couched in public health terms of this menace to really scare people. And they had to use a new terminology of marijuana because everyone knew what cannabis was. They knew how important it was. But marijuana sounded Mexican and it was something that could be scary. And, you know, they could railroad through this new legislation without spooking everybody that, hey, you're trying to tank the market value globally of the most important global commodity to humanity. Why would you do that? That seems like a evil conspiracy to try to gain market share for your newly discovered petrochemical products. So if you look at a graph, you know, of these commodities competing, prohibition tanked the value of cannabis down to zero. It was just like the stock market for cannabis crashed because the legislation changed and the value of the entire industry overnight went from billions globally to nothing. And so that's not the default state. That's not a stable state. There's been a lot of energy and, you know, resource put into shoring up that narrative. And, you know, you and I both saw in our lifetimes as cannabis activists, the amount of energy that was required to maintain prohibition. It's not a sustainable situation.
Exactly. And we'll be right back after these messages, ladies and gentlemen. You listen to the Vinnie Eastwood Show.com on Republic Broadcasting Network. Back in the tech. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the show that's all about getting your Luftwaffe aloft. It's the Vinnie Eastwood Show. And my very special guest, Abe Gray from the New Zealand Cannabis Museum. That was the last ad break that we'll have to go through. So we are going to return to Abe now, and we've got another 25 minutes in the broadcast left to fill up with amazing cannabis knowledge. And just on that point, you can talk to somebody who's an expert in cannabis history, lore, L-O-R-E, as it is, endlessly, because the array of things that cannabis can do and is so extraordinary that you could literally spend a lifetime researching it and never know it all.
That's kind of what I've been doing. But just for your benefit this morning, Vinny, I smoked less cannabis than usual to try to contain my rambling.
Well, I mean, for your benefit, I smoked more. So it's we've balanced out and met in the middle, I think.
We've got here. Yeah, I mean, basically, as you say, the possibilities are endless. That's why a cannabis museum is such a powerful communication tool, because there's so many stories to tell. And that's what I was saying before, you know, about prohibition being not sustainable. The default state of cannabis is king, like the ultimate commodity for human society. We co-evolve together. That's our natural state. This, you know, this current state we're in is basically being, you know, forced on us and promoted by nefarious forces. That's not how we should naturally be, but that's good news, because it's fighting against the laws of thermodynamics. You know, if things were just left to their natural state, cannabis would be king again. And that's what we're experiencing, because there's not enough resources to continue to keep up the charade of prohibition. And I think, so, you know, if you look at that line graph of the economic value of cannabis being tanked overnight with prohibition, what we're seeing now is it rising back up to its natural state. And in some ways, it's like, you know, surfing a wave. If you can see that wave starting to form and you can paddle in there before it crests, then you can get in that sweet spot and ride that wave. And so I think those of us who have been cannabis activists for a long time, that's the position we're in now, because we can see that sea change coming. And I guess, you know, for those of us who have been suspicious of governments and authorities, especially through the lens of prohibition, and kind of learned about all these other, you know, conspiratorial machinations besides just reefer madness and prohibition that have also gone on with these same actors in the same powerful positions in governments, it does make you wonder, why now? Why is cannabis being allowed to be legalized? Like, you know, is there some ulterior motive, as there quite often is in the past? But I prefer not to dwell on that at the moment, because I think that's probably true. And I mean, that's probably true in a lot of cases. But what we're seeing with cannabis liberalization, it is a net positive, I think, and especially for our community. Yes, certainly there's persecution and control structures that, you know, operate over us in other ways. And, you know, some very unexpected ones seem to appear all of a sudden right at the time when cannabis was being legalized. So that's very unfortunate. But yeah, sticking to the topic of cannabis, I think that what we are seeing is kind of a renaissance. And it is, you know, it is ultimately healthy for people and society to have more cannabis and more hemp in our lives. And unwinding these pathologized reefer madness narratives is a big job. And that's why we need this museum. And the museum is, you know, more than just a static historical installation. It's also like a community center. And it's like a networking hub for those of us who are interested or enthusiastic about cannabis to kind of share that. And yeah, it's being done in a very grassroots, decentralized way. And it's definitely something people should experience. I think there's other cannabis museums around the world. The one that we're modeled after is the one that's in Amsterdam and Barcelona. And that was very much an activist project that's been around for decades. Now, with cannabis liberalization, you know, occurring in a lot of jurisdictions all at once, the domino is starting to fall really quickly. We're seeing a lot of like museum formats, but kind of like, you know, chintzy tourist attractions or just straight corporate, you know, sales vehicles. And yeah, that's not what we are here. Although, you know, in the future, I guess, as the cannabis market and industry develops in New Zealand, I guess we'd, you know, it wouldn't be so bad to be a solvent business one day.
Yeah, and now with the concentration of cannabis into all sorts of alcohol based things, that you can have a solvent business indeed.
That was not a bad joke. That was a good one.
You're welcome. They can't all be bad, but they can be very bad indeed. I was also thinking about this concept where if you're talking about the cannabis topic politically, how there's a number of ignorant people out there who will choose to, you know, deride you and run you down and things of that nature. Now, the net positive of cannabis liberalization really means something. And what's interesting about this particular phase of history is I think perhaps the reason why it is being liberalized and legalized is, number one, certain cannabis movements around the world got themselves very organized. They had some people who were very professional, who knew how to manipulate the public mind just as the enemies of mankind do, and they used those exact same tools. Instead of using dark propaganda, they used light propaganda, which is to propagate an idea. And the idea being propagated was that this is less harmful than alcohol, and alcohol is out there all the time. I don't feel safe around people who drink large quantities of alcohol, whereas I could be around a whole bunch of people that smoke large amounts of cannabis, and I don't feel unsafe at all, because the worst thing they're going to do is pass out on the couch and eat a cookie, all right? These are you know, dangerous social diseases. The whole idea behind legalization and liberalization stems back to the prohibition in the first place and the actors involved. Why did they get rid of it? Well, because they wanted to control all the various industries and things of that nature that oil could participate in if cannabis wasn't there. So are those same interests bringing cannabis back in to occupy all those spaces where they know that cannabis is useful, but it may need to be able to control that, just like they were able to control oil, doing it both legislatively and, dare I say it, genetically, and modifying plants and things of that nature, patenting them so that they can maintain control of them, breed them in certain ways so that the ways in which it makes you question authority and things of that nature isn't there anymore, or make sure you only have the CBD so that you only get half of the therapeutic effect when it's whereas it should be combined with the THC, and that's how nature works. I just see all of these things. But of course, as you're saying, yes, it's a net positive, and here's why. There's a lot of people who are anarchists in this world, people who don't want to be ruled, all right? That's what anarchy really means. And what the anarchist movement has said is that it doesn't mean you can't participate in politics. It doesn't mean you can't run for your local government or something like that. What it means is, if your goal is to not have any rulers, you can't just have that overnight. You need step by step by step to remove those controls, remove the untruths, and eventually get to where you're going. It's not a be-all or end-all. So is cannabis legalization and liberalization a stepping stone to something better? I believe it is. But of course, we do need to be cognizant of these same old games that get played. And once you know the game, you see it in virtually every sector. And I think that's why a lot of people who become cannabis activists later become conspiracy theorists, because if you see something wrong in one area and you apply those principles, you can see those same things being wrong in many others.
Well, the book that radicalized me as a young person was The Emperor Wears No Clothes by Jack Herrera. And, you know, it's a parable of the classic children's story. And it just laid it out.
By the way, Jack insisted that it be pronounced Hera, like Terra. But go ahead.
Oh, yeah.
Mine too, actually. I was just before I got busted that I got handled that hemp by all. You know.
Yeah, and so, I mean, basically, what it, you know, it laid out so clearly is like governments lied, colluded, manipulated with industry to create a, you know, public panic using propaganda on this particular issue. Now, maybe it was just that issue, but those same people held powerful positions across other sectors and industries, and other dramatic reforms took place, you know, at the same time and subsequently, and their children and their children's children have stayed in those powerful positions. And so, yeah, it makes you wonder if maybe there were a few potential other, you know, instances of manipulation or collusion. I'll just leave it at that. But the museum, as you correctly described it, it is like that positive propaganda. That's what we conceived it as. It's a, you know, we were activists trying every communication method we could conceive of to get across this argument that non-problematic adult cannabis use, you know, should be allowed and respected, and those people, those users, have human rights. And we tried debates, we tried sit-ins, smoke-ins, you know, podcasts, radio shows, blogs, documentaries, street theater, you name it, debates. We're making the same argument every time. And a lot of times, you know, it didn't hit, or it got mocked or denigrated. But it was only sort of by accident and through our adjacency to the science communication program at Otago University that we discovered a new format that was, you know, hot stuff in 2011, and a format we had never used before. And we thought, oh, well, we may as well try that one. And that was the interactive museum exhibit. And it was so powerful that it went viral immediately. And we just realized that an interactive museum exhibit is kind of the penultimate communication tool, because it's a narrative that the patron, the consumer, sort of integrates as their own original thought, because each interactive experience gives them that light bulb moment of a fact that they haven't been preached to or politicized towards, but actually a genuine fact that they discovered themselves. And then they become very evangelistic about it. And, you know, here in New Zealand, institutions, we're a bilingual country. Usually institutions have like a Maori name as well. And more recently, it's come away from like a direct transliteration of, you know, what that institution is, just like using Maori words, and more of like a embodiment of the ethos, or what they, in Maori, what they call the kaupapa of the actual project. And that's not something you make up yourself. That's something that you have to ask the local elders to sort of give to you. And when we did that, we were expecting, you know, some sort of name about green, or, you know, or drug or health or something. And we were hoping that it wouldn't be derogatory because of this stigma that's been around. But the name they came back with us is Whakamana, and that means empowerment. And so really, like, I mean, I guess we should have realized, but they realized that that's what we were doing, is actually empowering people. And our ethos wasn't so much about cannabis or using it or smoking it, or the core of what we were doing is trying to empower people to think for themselves. And that's why cannabis politics is such a important lens. And that's why I've devoted my life to it, because myself as a young, you know, dropkick teenager, just, you know, wanting to get high and thinking about myself, I stumbled upon this, you know, this secret history of prohibition and reefer madness. And it really, it opened up my eyes, and it radicalized me politically. And I feel like, you know, all of the disconnected youth and even adults who are disconnected from politics in our society, that's really the problem, is unempowered, disengaged citizens glued to their screens, being fed this brainwashing programming, right? And we need to break that cycle. And one thing that gets people to sort of turn their head for a second is cannabis. And if you can capture them in that double take moment where they're, you know, where they're open to receiving information, and for a brief second they're taken out of that propaganda tunnel and they're open to hearing new information because they saw this totem of the cannabis leaf that they recognize, and that we instinctively recognize evolutionarily from our 10,000 year history. And then, you know, you can empower them. And so, yeah, that's why I'm so passionate about this issue in the museum, because for me, it was a lens of someone who is totally disengaged, you know, self-centered consumer, to all of a sudden become awake and aware about politics and radicalized and activated as a participating citizen. And if we could do that to everyone, or at least a lot more people, I think we'd be a lot better off. And in our spectacle-driven consumer society, the only paradigm that I've found that seems to cut through every time and gives us that moment to sort of, you know, re-engineer people to be empowered citizens, that's what drives me, and that's what I think we've been able to do.
It's because it's the other people who'll be able to do the things that you and I can't do, right? You've got skills that I don't, and vice versa. And the more people that you get involved in any movement by activating them, this is the, you know, to respire, to breathe. To inspire is to breath within, and that is what they call the mark of divinity, to give that breath to another person so that they breathe with you. And this is a cause, and unfortunately every cause will betray you, and it means that regardless of how much you sacrifice or how much you give or how good you are, there will be consequences for doing the right thing. And that's why it's kind of like, it's been a generational effort after, like, what, 90 years of prohibition or something like that. I wonder how many cannabis activists there were initially. Like, you know how nowadays we've got, like, C-SPAN in the United States, and when they pass a piece of legislation that's really bad, there's some senator or some congressman rubbishing it and saying we shouldn't pass this bill, etc. I haven't seen the debates and things of that nature from that era, because this was long before those kind of things were televised. And I wonder what was going through those minds of those people right then, that this is going to destroy the world as we know it and we can't stop it.
Well, that's the other important aspect of the museum, is recording that history and not letting it be lost or rewritten, right? Because history is written by the victors. But you can flip that around, and if you write the history, then you decide who the victor was. And that's where we came in with the museum, because, you know, we had this vibrant protest movement on the Otago campus for a decade, and the university pretended it didn't exist. The city council pretended it didn't exist. We were basically being written out of history. And it was clear to us that unless we form our own institution to record this history correctly and truthfully, will be edited out. You know, the official histories of the 2000s at Otago University make no mention of the 420s, even though you and I both know it was the largest protest group and one of the largest clubs on campus for a decade. And so that, you know, those debates that you mentioned historically, they did occur. And there were some amazing, like, way ahead of their time, prescient, free-thinking, free speech warriors, you know, even in the government at that time.
Like LaGuardia.
Like LaGuardia, like Lindbergh. And look, they all had baggage as well related to that time. You know, historically, people had weird attitudes about other things as well. So these people aren't, you know, infallible saints, but they did get it about cannabis at that time, and they were saying the right things, and those things have been buried and suppressed. I mean, if it wasn't for Jack Herer and his research going into The Emperor Wears No Clothes, that famous 1942 newsreel of Hemp for Victory, no one would have ever known it existed. It was stashed away. All the copies had been burned, and there was one left stashed away in a corner in the Library of Congress in a pile of shit that nobody cared about or looked at. And Jack happened to find it and sort of smuggle it out, you know, get it put onto tape, share it with the world. And that censorship of history is happening all the time. So if we don't form our own institution to complete these narratives correctly and, you know, to lionize these important historical individuals, no one's going to do it for us. And, you know, the military-industrial complex certainly isn't, because they're trying to tell the opposite story.
It's a brutal measure that must be taken, and to be ruthless, I think, because the truth really doesn't care how people feel about cannabis. The truth is the truth. That is what it is. And people need to shut up and accept it like a bunch of adults. And unfortunately, when I look at the voting public or just the general public, I do not see adults walking round. I see fully grown children, and they are too cowardly, apathetic, ignorant, and lazy in the majority of the time to do anything about it. But what's good is that a very small percentage of people who are adults, who do think, who do feel, who are willing to sacrifice for the truth, is basically all that's necessary. It's like that that lady said, I forget her name now, a small determined group of people are going to change history because they're the only thing that that does.
Well, and that brings me back to my earlier point. You know, apathetic, ignorant, lazy teenagers love cannabis. So that's the hook to get them in. Hey, you love cannabis. Look at this. And little did you know, we're going to empower you to become an active citizen and transform you from that lazy, ignorant teenage mentality into empowered, intelligent, you know, engaged citizen, thinking for yourself, not thinking what we tell you to think, but really integrating, you know, and you know, really thinking about what you believe. That's what we can do. So you're absolutely right. The majority of consumers out there, they're just sleepwalking. They're just consuming. They have that selfish teenage mentality. But cannabis kind of plays into that. And if we can get them, you know, sitting, relaxing, conversing with other empowered individuals, and, you know, when they have that toke, like you said, 30 seconds later, they're starting to think of things from different perspectives. And if they're surrounded by empowered individuals, that's what we call deprogramming.
Abe, thank you so much for your time today. And where can people find out more about you?
Yeah, so Whakamana Cannabis Museum, that's Whakamana. I have to apologize to any North American fans. We didn't really think that through in terms of how easy it would be for you to spell or understand. But as I say, it was gifted to us by a Kamatua. That's the process. But cannabis.kiwi.nz is our website. And you can find us on Facebook at Cannabis Museum, Twitter at Cannabis Museum, Instagram at Cannabis Museum NZ. We weren't quick enough on that one. The Ohio guys beat us to that handle. But yeah, if you just Google New Zealand Cannabis Museum, you'll find some very rich history. And there's a great catalog of articles, you know, spanning the last 10 years, videos, etc.
Indeed. Thank you so much for your time, Abe. It's been an absolute pleasure as always.
Thank you for having me, Vinny. I really appreciate it.
Cheers, brother. All right, and there's the music, folks. Go to thevinnyeastwoodshow.com and donate today, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you so much for your support, and thank you very much for my very special guest, Abe Gray, and, of course, Republic Broadcasting Network. We'll see you again sometime, folks.